comes now a time in my life when I can take a backward look and sum up the main events of my sojourn in this sphere of existence. My parents were pioneers coming to the state of Iowa in the year 1848 from Indiana. They brought with them very little of this world's goods, but had an abundant confidence in themselves to make a home and rear a family in the new state. They were the product of the pioneer stock which conquered the wilderness of the Middle West. Their ancestors had found the forces of nature for the freedom of thought and action. My father's forebears were of Holland Dutch extraction from the settlement of New Amsterdam. My mother was born in North Carolina, her father being a German and her mother an Englishwoman. Both had pioneered from the old countries in search of the liberty denied them in their native land. Neither of my parents had received instruction in books. My mother learned to read and write after her marriage, and when I first remember her, she was reading such books as Josephus' History of the Jews and Shakespeare's plays. I now know that she read them with understanding. I was the last, but one, of a family of 8 children, 4 boys and 4 girls, but 3 of us survive. My oldest and my youngest sister and I visited the place where I was born this summer. I am now 69 years of age, and for the first time since I remember, I saw the farm where I first drew breath. Near a little hamlet where only the little frame church and a weather-beaten store building remain in the county of Keokuk, and about halfway between Sigourney and Wutcheer, the county seat, and once a prosperous coal town. My sister tells me that at the date of my birth, the forest covered the whole country, but now pleasant farmsteads fill the landscape. My father enlisted as a soldier in the Federal Army when I was 2 weeks old. My first memories are of the return of the veterans and the pride of my mother in fitting me out as an infant Zouave in blue and gold, and I received with my milk an intense hatred of rebels, and imbibed the thought that all Democrats were rebels and things to be held in abhorrence. During the War of the Rebellion, we moved to a thinly settled strip of country, it being the prairie between the English and Skunk Rivers, which had been neglected because the early settlers preferred to take their farms near the rivers where timber was abundant, and though the land was not so fertile as that of the prairies, it afforded the comfort of a plentiful supply of logs with which to build and fuel to comfort them. The settling of the prairies was delayed until the great white pine lumber interests began to float rafts to points along the Mississippi River. When it became possible to build frame pioneer homes far from the supply of timber, my father bought 160 acres of this land for $1,600 and built a board dwelling 16 by 32, 2 rooms, the boards being set perpendicularly and the cracks covered with batting, thin strips about 3 inches wide, and nailed to the upright siding. The 1-inch walls were then lined with coarse straw paper. Our housing for the stock were built of pine lumber and covered with a thatch of coarse slope grass. And after we had raised a crop of small grain, the cattle were sheltered under pole sheds covered with the straw. There were miles of open range, and game was abundant. Prairie chickens were so plentiful as to become a nuisance by tearing down the standing corn and fodder, and the waterfowl were so numerous that during the seasonal migrations, farmers were compelled to guard the fields from their depredations. With the melting of the snows and before the drifts had disappeared, the south winds would bring great rolling clouds to the everlasting wonderment and admiration of myself and my sister Emma, who was my constant companion, we having been the last born of 8 children. I was 5 years younger than my brother John, and Emma being 23 months younger than I, hence by age we were naturally segregated from the others and became fast friends. This friendship has been continued in a greater degree than between any of the others. We would watch the mounting clouds and the vast flights of north-going waterfowl, the geese flying in great V-shaped formation and honking their arrival or passage, the cranes heralding their coming with the musical frog-like croak. It was a never-ending delight to watch their flight. Many times have I stalked these birds while they were resting and feeding, once getting so close to the crane sentinel before he saw me that instead of warning his flock, he came menacingly toward me, and before I took to my heels, he seemingly towered over me. When I looked back, the flock had taken wing and flying in an ever-widening circle and getting ever higher until mere specks in the sky, they straightened to the north and ever sending down their farewell cries at last disappeared on their way to make a home and rear their yearly families. The wide prairies grew luxuriant grasses, which, for want of someone to use the crop, died on the ground, and when spring came, it was the usual thing for the settlers to fire the grass, and these fires would make the evenings wonderful, with their licking flames shooting high in the air and sending forth a weird light. Our evenings were rendered delightful. The beginnings of spring, the cackling of the frogs, the notes of the migrating bird life, the moon and the stars made for us a talking movie, God-made and priceless, yet for us without cost. Then the gradual covering of green clothed the earth. The flowers peeped forth in abundance. Meadowlarks piped the cheerful nesting calls. Bobolinks sent forth their peens of praise. Seeds were sown in the ground. Summer came apace with all the activities, the cultivating, harvesting of small grains and the threshing season, then the preparation of fall plowing for the next season, and the gathering of the corn, denuded of husks by hand as it stood in the field and stored in cribs for our winter use. What joy we had in childhood of the year, the breathless heat of the growing summer, the quiet, restful Indian summer of the fall and the invigorating rigor of our northern winter springtime of our lives, when weeks were as years and years were as centuries. Yet our lives were filled with joy. We were a pioneer family among pioneers. Two old country German families were our closest neighbors, and an old country Scotch settlement formed a large part of the community. All were frugal, hard-working people, and few were the luxuries enjoyed by any. Our wheat was made into flour by the water mills. Our barley was sold to the local breweries. For along the Skunk River, many Germans had settled, and they had brought into the country their customs. Our corn we made into meal and hominy, and plenty of good homemade pork provided good wholesome food. We rode to meetings in farm wagons, sometimes using chairs for seats. Community bickerings and jealousies were rare. Our schools were primitive. The schoolhouse was ordinarily just a rectangular one-story building where one teacher was employed to teach all from the primer class to the highest branches, which usually ended with the sixth reader and raised third-grade arithmetic. Sometimes as many as 70 pupils attended, and the school year was divided into terms of 3 months in the winter, 2 months in the spring, and 2 months in the fall only. The younger children attended the spring and fall terms, and so the pupils in the higher age had only the winter months to acquire. Learning books were rare, and our library consisted of the Bible and Josephus. Our nearest Scotch neighbor had a copy of Shakespeare and a Life of Washington. Our social life was bounded by Sunday meetings, singing schools, and spelling schools. These last were held in the several schoolhouses where once or twice a week during the winter we would gather and raise our voices in song or vie in the art of oral spelling. Here the young swains would indulge in personal encounters to settle youthful disputes, in the background of which was ordinarily the witchery of some lovely maiden. Such animosities were short-lived, and the contestants in many bloody fisticuffs became the best of friends. We lived on this farm until I was 14 years old. I helped with the farm work to the extent of my ability and attended the schools. The first school was 1 1/4 miles east of our house, and the second was 3/4 of a mile west. To these two country schools I was sent, and there I acquired what little knowledge was to be had, up to the time when I imagined that I'd like to know all there was for man to learn. This liking for knowledge was forced upon me. When I was 12 years old, I was stricken with typhoid, and on recovering from the fever, found that I was doomed to be a lifelong cripple. For 2 years, I was able to get about a little, with the aid of crutches, my left leg being drawn crooked at the knee, and the knee joint was immovable, and the bones, both above and below the knee, had been affected so that open sores discharged pus continuously. For nearly 20 years, I suffered with this handicap, and though after the first 2 years I was able to perform much manual labor, I would have to resort to my crutches occasionally. By much effort and almost constant manipulation, I recovered the use of the knee joint, but never so that it was safe for me to forget its weakness. Left largely to my own resources, I began reading Shakespeare's works, Josephus, the Bible, and soon I developed a real liking for the thoughts of the great men, and while my introduction to the great authors was of my own seeking, I found those great authors always ready to welcome me and indulge my ignorance and ever ready to extend to me their wisdom in full measure of my ability to receive it. Thus I found companionship for which I stood in great need. To be sure, my sister was ever ready to comfort me, but at home I was an added burden to the family, and after I was able to limp back to school, the children made my school life rather unbearable. Youth rather follows the instincts of the lower animals, and a cripple in the school fared as badly as a crippled duck in the barnyard. I was taunted by them on account of my misfortune, barred from games and nicknamed Crip. And for the first 2 years, had it not been for my sister and the author friends I was making, I think I should have become a surly, ill-conditioned boy and warped beyond straightening. This treatment aroused in me the spirit of resentment and determined me in overcoming the defects thus pointed out to me, and by continual efforts on my part, I became able to walk without the help of crutches and recovered my general health, and my body recovered much of the natural symmetry of form. Though I did not grow in height after my sickness more than 2 inches, and that possibly saved me from showing much lameness, but my diseased leg was at that 1/2 inch shorter than the other. By constant care and thought I recovered to the extent that I was not noticeably lame, and at the age of 17 became rather able to compete with others of my age in play and labor. I had not become morose, but had become very sensitive and was alert to notice any slight, many times fancied, but always resented. I had a happy boyhood, but no youth. At the age of 18 or 19, friendships came again to me, and I began to get acquainted with my fellow humans. About this time, I had the first real interest in the fair sex aroused, and as I had not been mingling much with my kind, and especially with the young women, the deep affection which seemed to elevate me above the sordid things of the world, combined with my familiarity with Shakespeare's heroines, led me to adore not only the one, but all women. My chosen fair one seemed to be angelic, not to be profaned by close approach, but to be worshipped as some superior being and held sacred from the baser things of life. I have always rejoiced that through this influence that I escaped many of the pitfalls due to base sex indulgence and led me to live a decent life in that respect. It has been my good fortune to have had the love of some good women, and I can say that none of them ever had any reason to regret having cared for me, and whatever of good that I may have accomplished was due to the inspiration of some woman's love. The winter after I was 18, the county superintendent of schools, after hearing me in my school work, asked me to come to the county seat and try for a certificate to teach school. I went and obtained a license to teach, but was not able to get a school, so I worked on my brother's farm at $14 per month and my board and washing. The next spring, the old family doctor persuaded my father to have my lame leg operated on. This was done at home, and the only result was that I almost lost my life by septicemia. I well remember seeing the family gathered around my bed awaiting my last hour on earth, but after a prolonged fight, I recovered my usual health and again went to work at farming. My interest in public affairs was aroused by the assassination of President Garfield. We celebrated the 4th of July that year at a picnic at Kyoto, Iowa, and our hopes were high that our loved president would survive. His lingering illness kept us diligently reading the papers, and this kept me busy trying to know more about the working of our democratic form of government. I soon found that I would have to better equip myself in mental attainments in order to understand, and I began to follow up the beginnings I had in the public school by reviewing all of my studied and by getting further information from books in the higher branches. So by self-study, I prepared myself to sometime enter college. But after acquiring a technically perfect book knowledge of grammar, I still retained the language of my parents, which they had acquired in the wilds of the frontier in Indiana. When I did afterwards get to college, I became the butt of many jibes at my manner of speech. I had to learn to talk after I was 20 years old. This effort to speak correct English made me slow of speech because of hunting for the correct words and the correct pronunciation. This habit I have never been able to wholly discard, and I still find myself relegating into patois under excitement. After working as a hired hand for a neighbor, Tom Shoup, I took my first long trip by a wagon loaded with household goods going from eastern Iowa to Pawnee City, Nebraska, in the fall of 1882. Shoup had bought a farm near that town, and I stayed in that country till January, 1883. When I got home, I found that my sister Emma was teaching school, and that persuaded me to again try for a certificate, which I obtained and taught a spring term of 2 months at what was named Black Hawk District, about 14 miles from home and near the Skunk River. Having but about 14 pupils, I had plenty of time to study. Most of my time was spent on Webster's Unabridged Dictionary. I boarded with an old couple named Marquis, and there I learned to smoke tobacco. The picture of this old couple with pipes in their mouths sitting before the fireplace in the cool evenings remains vivid as a sample of domestic felicity. I have been writing in the first person, but now feel that in retrospect I seem more of a distinct and separate personality to my present self, and that by observing the actions and studying the motives of this personality, as in the second person, I will not be constantly met with the question of egotism. I shall continue this narrative by using the second person in imparting to those who may be interested my impressions of my former self. As I look back upon those early years now set down, the course of my life turned from boyhood trials and aspirations into the wider path that followed. When I returned from Nebraska, my sister had left home to make her own way as a teacher, and the home seemed so bare and lonely without her that I felt the full weight of that change. Recognizing that home life as I had known it was broken, I tried to adjust myself and began thinking of the future in terms of my own individuality. I was still under the spell of my first love, and that early emotion, an adoration more than a mere attachment, remained one of the most beneficent influences of my youth. My belief in her innocence and purity became my measure of all women, and that ideal shielded me from the ordinary dangers of youthful sex relations. We were promised to each other, but because she belonged to a Catholic family, she was fated to marry within her faith. She honored me, however, by naming one of her 14 children Ben F. She has long been gone, but her memory has remained one of the sustaining influences of my life. After teaching my first term of school, I worked on my brother's farm until fall and then taught a winter term in the Shenoah School District, boarding with a family of strict observers of the Sabbath whose interpretation of the commandment emphasized rest above all else. Not far from my boarding place lived Nick Henderson, a man considered an infidel by his neighbors. He had adopted two children and kept a sizable library, professing himself a spiritualist. I attended seances with him, though I never possessed enough imagination to see disembodied spirits, despite others in the circle claiming they did. Because I was deeply interested in books, I picked up one day a volume titled The Gods. Its first sentence was seared into my memory. Having been raised to orthodox thinking, that sentence, "An honest God is the noblest work of man," struck me as the very acme of blasphemy. I put the book down as though it were a voice from the lower regions, yet the sentence continued to prod my thoughts. Finally, yielding to my curiosity, I read the book through. That moment marked the beginning of my study of religions. The book awakened in me a desire to understand not only the Christian God I had been taught to worship, but the gods of all peoples since the birth of human thought. Never again, after reading that book, did I condemn anyone for honest belief or disbelief in any religion. Recognizing the good in each, I learned to honor sincere faith wherever I found it. The core of all religions, as I came to see it, was that the Spirit of Truth, the Holy Spirit, that bit of celestial wisdom planted by the Almighty in every human mind, was leading all people toward a higher and more humane sphere of action. Understanding the harsh law of the survival of the fittest, I also came to recognize a higher and more noble law, that of service, which raises humanity into an atmosphere of love and mutual help. This truth was taught by all great reformers and brought to us most simply and beautifully in the words of Jesus, "Whatsoever thou wouldst that men should do unto you, do ye even so to them." From then on, my test for all people became, "By their fruit shall ye know them." It was not what one professed, but what one did that measured the degree of the Holy Spirit within them. With the savings from teaching, I entered the Eastern Iowa Normal School at Columbus Junction, Iowa. After passing the examination, I worked at whatever jobs would help pay my way and succeeded in staying long enough to earn a B.S. degree. The school, founded by Professor E.R. Eldridge, was one of the pioneer institutions of the state and enrolled about 200 students. It offered one great advantage. Each student was allowed to think for himself and to advance as rapidly as he could prove by examination that he had mastered the required material. The 2 years I spent there enlisted me in a lifelong pursuit of knowledge and a desire to understand the world and its many phenomena. These years were broken by intervals during which I taught school, worked at the Columbus Safeguard newspaper office, owned and operated a bookstore, and taught the grammar school in the same town. In the winter of 1884 to 1885, I taught as superintendent of the Kinross Schools in Keokuk County, Iowa. During that time, my parents sold their property and moved to Kansas, settling near Peabody. That summer, I went to Kansas and homesteaded in Finney County, about 20 miles north of Garden City, claiming a quarter section of land and also taking up a timber claim in Wichita County. I did the necessary work on both. At that time, the country was an endless prairie with almost no improvements. Outside of Garden City, no human habitation was visible, yet before the summer ended, small board shanties and sod houses dotted the landscape, county seats appeared and boasted populations of 3,000 to 4,000, large brick public buildings arose, and rival towns even fought with guns for the honor of being named county capitals. Coronado and Leoti were two such rivals. Leoti ultimately won. 10 years later, while on a business trip to Leoti, I found its population reduced to 3 families, with only the immense courthouse and school buildings still standing, monuments to the courage and fortitude of the early Western pioneers. When I returned from Kansas to Iowa in the fall of that year, I sought employment and was recommended by a college mate to a country district in Muscatine County, traveling by train to Muscatine and then hiring a horse for the trip into the country. I met the school board. They seemed to like my appearance and hired me on the spot for the winter term. After paying for the horse rental, I discovered that my entire fortune consisted of a single nickel. Though I had already registered at the best hotel in town, I enjoyed a good dinner, bought a cigar with my nickel, and stepped outside, wondering what my next move would be. Fortunately, I soon encountered a schoolmate attending the teachers' convention. After hearing my predicament, he took me in hand, paid my hotel bill, and provided enough money to get me back to Columbus Junction, where I had friends ready to help me through my depression. Within a few days, another schoolmate and I bought a local bookstore on credit and succeeded in making it profitable enough that I resigned my teaching position and settled into business. But soon trouble arose in the town school. The grammar room pupils had rebelled, bullying 3 teachers into quitting. The board hired me to restore order, telling me frankly that they chose me because of my reputation as a fighter earned during my college days. Before agreeing, I insisted upon full control without interference from the superintendent, an elderly man who had lost the ability to support his teachers. The room held about 50 pupils between the ages of 14 and 18, including a dozen large boys who had caused the most trouble. The first day passed cautiously, with both teacher and pupils sizing each other up. On the second day, the ringleader, a cross-eyed boy nearly 6 feet tall, began the customary mischief, making faces and creating noise. I called him to my desk in a calm, polite voice. When he approached, I seized his shirt collar, gave him a half turn, and applied 2 or 3 strokes with the hazel sprouts I had brought for that purpose. That evening, the boy's father, accompanied by several of the boy's friends, entered the bookstore where I was posting the day's receipts. With many profanities, he announced that he had come to thrash me. I told him it would be a pleasure to punish him as a bad father and leaped over the table to reach him. He retreated in haste. He later demanded my dismissal before the school board, but the chairman, a Presbyterian preacher, told him plainly that as long as I did not kill any of the unruly boys, the board intended to retain me. From then on, the grammar room's good behavior became the talk of the town. The following spring, I sold the bookstore and returned to college to complete my course. I was then employed as superintendent of the Columbus City Schools for the last 3 months of the year, and later contracted to serve in that role for the entire following year. However, I married in May and was offered a better position in Hillsboro, Kansas. I accepted and remained there 2 years. In May of the second year, our first child was born. Our daughter, Ethel Claire, now grown, married, and with a family of 4 children of her own, a boy and 3 girls, all physically and mentally sound. They fill my heart with pride, and I cherish being called Granddad. I had long planned to become a physician and surgeon, and during our 2 years in Hillsboro, I read medicine under the tutelage of Dr. C. E. Fulton, my brother-in-law, who took great care to prepare me for that profession.